You're listening to Truth to You Radio on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org. Also available on iTunes. I'm Jono, and good day to Rebecca, who commented saying, I would just like to say that thank you to both Yoel and Jono for the time and effort you both put into this program. I imagine it must take a great deal of preparation and work, and I'm grateful that you are both willing to do so for a program that is provided free of charge. She goes on to say, I would also like to remind the listeners that they do not have to pay a subscription fee for these programs, nor are they required to listen to them, and as such, have complete freedom to stop listening at any time if they find that the programs are not to their liking. I personally find that the lack of political correctness in this series refreshing. This world has enough people in it cloaking, sugarcoating, and withholding the truth from people. I appreciate you both for being willing to make the truth known, whether it is the truth about Yehovah or the truth about global circumstances. Thank you for all you do, and please don't stop. Well, thank you, Rebecca, for your comment. That's a marvelous comment. We really do appreciate it. And wherever you may be around the world, it's good to have your company. Of course, it is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
Hey to you, too. So for those who don't understand why we read this comment, it's because one of the programs about 2 weeks ago, I spoke about the issue of Islam, and there were complaints.
There was some...
One complaint I actually heard, and I feel for the person. The person said that they have a hard time getting employment, and they don't need this. This is like a refuge for them. That I feel. And I want to send a prayer out here that, because I know a lot of people, specifically in the United States, are having trouble with work. A lot of people are getting fired. I personally have people who wanted to learn Hebrew, and then they cancel because they say they've been fired from their jobs. And life is getting slightly tough in the United States, and hopefully, God willing, the situation there will fix itself, everything will go back on track, and it'll cause the entire world to go back on track. And I feel for that person, and listen to programs like this is a refuge for them, something they can relax back into. And I understand that, because, for example, when I sit down and study, it helps me go back and relax and focus on the more important things in the world. So again, to that person specifically, I feel. But the other person who said something about me generalizing about Arabs, etc., and Christians, etc., I did not generalize Arabs. I was speaking about Islam. I actually have quite a few Arab friends and people I worked with, and I want to say something very, very quickly. They have a thing called a berserk button. Arabs in general come from a very violent society. It's nothing has to do with their personalities. Okay, I remember a conversation I had years ago with a friend of mine who, by the way, was not a Palestinian and would not allow anyone calling Palestinian, by the way, who had this berserk button. And he admitted to me several times that their society has a problem. Now, he specifically was a Muslim, but we were very, very good friends. Seriously, I actually even went to his village to meet his family. This is how close we were, okay, to be very, very blunt. So claiming I was generalizing Arabs, not true. But there is an issue with Islam, and that was the point. The main point. So rather going and being, you know, going around and pointing out why were you doing this and that, just focus on what I did say, which was positive, because I don't know how many Arabs you might know. I know hundreds of Arabs. I've met Arabs from also all over the world, and I can say something very, very simple. There are people, and there are people. I'm not generalizing about Arabs. When it comes to Muslims, there are Muslims, and there also are Muslims. I'm admitting to that, but when it comes to Islam in general, if you ever sit down and study the books of Islam, you will know. And that's the problem. How many people in the crowd can lift their hand and say, I have read the hadith, I have read the Quran, I have heard the imam speak in the mosque. How many people would actually say they know Arabic? How many people can actually say they can listen to the Arabic speech and figure out what the person is saying? None. And that's the game that's played. Now, I don't really speak Arabic, but some Arabic I do know. And believe me, I've heard with my own two ears what Arab sheikhs and muftis say in mosques, and it has necessarily have to do with Jews. It has to do with anyone who is not a Muslim. And my friend Rico Cortez does one very interesting thing. When he brings groups to Israel, he takes them also to the Holocaust Museum. And he says something very, very simple. He says, you want to be in covenant with the God of Israel, this can happen. Mm-hmm. And this is where you have to keep your eyes peeled and be aware of things. And to the person who said that, you know, God will take care of everything, yes and no. Sometimes we can't really sit and say, oh, it's going to be easy, so we'll put legs up and say, you know, God's going to take care of everything. And unfortunately, for example, people said that throughout centuries, and they're dead. Mm. And they were killed because they said, we're not going to pick up arms. Which, by the way, is related to the issue of the book of Joshua. God was actually with them, but he said, you have to fight.
Mm-hmm. Actually, we're going to be touching on that specifically in the first few chapters.
If you look at the history, basically from the Exodus, when God himself walked out with the people of Israel as a pillar of fire and pillar of smoke, and they reached Amalekites, what does God say? You know, in this case, I want you to fight.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do it for you. I'm going to help you. I'm going to aid you, but I want you to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been consistent history throughout the centuries. You want to be saved? I'm not going to allow you to sit and do absolutely nothing. I'm going to tell you, go and fight.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's not consistent with Scripture, the idea of we're going to kick back and say God's going to take care of everything.
Sure.
You know, it's extremely rare that God does that. The only other case that we have something similar to the Exodus was when the state of Judea, the land of Judea under King Hezekiah was almost completely demolished, and the only city left was Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And only then God said, okay, I'm going to do something. And then they vanish. Mm-hmm. And how exactly they were destroyed is a whole discussion. But the fact remains, it actually did happen, because Herodotus actually mentions such a thing. Besides the Bible, we actually have exterior information of such a thing. Even in the Assyrian Chronicles, Sanherib never conquers Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
It never actually happens. You see, he conquers everyone. Jerusalem's not mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So there is such a thing where we can kick back and do everything. But on the other hand, throughout the centuries, wars are won through battle, not through kicking back and saying it's going to change.
Amen.
So I understand the spiritual belief thing that comes when people are believers in whatever they believe. But the fact remains, the world is still what it is, and the world still functions in the way it is. And I would say amen to that, you know, it's good, you know, we're going to kick back and everything is going to, God will fight for you and you'll just sit there being quiet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very rare that actually happens to that level. I mean, we have stories here and there. For example, a battle went wrong for the enemy and they lost whatever it is. You know, there are a few stories like that as well. You have the story with King Jehoshaphat, who, you know, they basically went out and they played music and sang praise to God. But that's extremely rare. Most wars are won by pulling out a sword and fighting. I'm not calling here to war, by the way. What I'm saying is, when you have an enemy, you have to take care of your enemy.
That's right. That's right.
And that was the point. And that's the connection to the book of Joshua and the book of Judges.
It is the point, and we're going to be touching on that in the first few chapters. Really brings it out quite nicely. But just to clarify, you were not generalizing Arabs. You were speaking of Islam in general, just for those who felt the controversy. So the controversy is not going to go away. What we're going to do now is jump into the book of Judges, and I'm really excited about this because this book is jam-packed with action, is it not? Oh, my goodness.
Act with action and a lot of sorrow. We can actually call it the Dark Ages of the Israelites.
Actually, that's a really good way of putting it.
It's a very, very problematic period of time.
Yeah.
Historically, causes a lot of confusions amongst the researchers, because I'll point out exactly why.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, let's deal with the name Judges. The name Shofet, the name of the book is Shoftim. Shoftim is a plural of the word Shofet.
Mm-hmm.
And what exactly is a Shofet? So when you open up a dictionary, whatever it is, just translates the word judge. But we're not dealing just with the concept of someone who sits there at the gate and he does trials. Actually, the word itself in most cases means a leader.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not called kings. They're not called a melech. They're called not even a nasi. They're called a shofet. Now, did they actually have
judicial function.
Exactly.
Did they have a judicial function?
It's a judicial function, exactly.
That's the one.
Did they actually have such a function in the people? And because the text sometimes says, He judged the people of Israel for 20 years. Did he actually function as a judge, or what exactly was he doing? Mm-hmm. And the issue is that really the word shofet in most of the cases actually means a leader of sorts, but it means a leader of a small group. Now, if you look at all the judges, they never actually controlled all the people of Israel. They only controlled a segment of tribes, yes, and sometimes a segment inside that tribe itself. Mm-hmm. We have several cases like that. Sure. But on the other hand, their job was also what's called a Moshiach, a savior. Mm-hmm. Now, the name Moshiach at one point becomes attributed only to the God of Israel, but it, really when you look at it, it's really this person is a Moshiach and is a savior. So the other part of it is a judge, and his children necessarily will continue his line. And that's the case with almost all the judges we have here, if not all of them. Mm-hmm. So that's also a very, very important thing. Now, the other thing is that there's a motif that appears in the book over and over again. En melech b'Yisrael, b'anim ha'im en melech b'Yisrael, ish ha'yashar ben av yaseh. In those days, there's no king in Israel. Each person does what's right for in his own eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a very, very important statement. Why is it a very, very important statement? It points out several things. First of all, it leads into the book of Samuel, because the book of Samuel is where the kingship starts. Mm-hmm. So all these books are linked to one another.
Yes.
It also causes you to understand that it's basically a lawless time. So people did whatever they wanted, which is very important for the issue of understanding the history of the time. There was a researcher called Segal years ago who wrote this book. And in the book, he actually tackles this interesting thing. A lot of archaeologists and researchers try to claim that the Israelites were tribes that nomaded for a while and then somehow reached this area. Some people say they were Canaanites, etc. Now, why are they saying this? It's because when they dig, they don't really find a difference in between Canaanites and Israelites. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, oh, the Israelites developed at one point when they became a kingship or something. But when you read the book of Judges, you kind of get the idea of what's going on. People were living together with the Canaanites, had strife with them every once in a while. There were times when it was more quiet, times when there was mm-hmm. more fights. But people were basically becoming very similar to the Canaanites.
They were assimilating.
They were assimilating, and this is part of the issue. They're assimilating to a point where they're also worshipping the Baal, or the Baalim, because there were different types of Baal. I know there was a general Baal, which was the Ugaritic or the Canaanite god, which is, by the way, a parallel to the character of Thor, because they're both thunder gods. Mm-hmm. And I actually used to have this book that actually showed. This man wrote a book where he was just trying to, you know, show the different deities from different mythologies. But when you read the book, you suddenly realize everyone's doing the same thing, just giving a different name.
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. So really, it's all derived from the same, more or less same idea. If you take the major gods, Thor, Baal, Zeus, yeah. Not the Egyptians, because Egyptians, you know, but yeah, they all were basically thunder gods. Mm. So it's kind of interesting. So it originates from more or less the same source. Now, what happened was at this time, where there was always like these situations where they're living, suddenly goes down, and they're sinning, and they suffer under someone, and then suddenly God sends a savior, and they go up. But they don't get kicked out of the land. They just, you know, go up and down. Mm-hmm. And the judge is still alive. Everything's fine. He dies and it goes down again. Mm-hmm. And this idea is also highly expressed here, because it's basically leading the idea that we actually need some kind of someone who'll be a permanent family of leaders, so to keep it always up. Mm-hmm. So when there were kings, there was still a lot of trouble. But it was a tad better, to be very, very blunt.
Sure. So because it was on a national level. The kingship was on a national level, and there was perhaps more uniformity in that sense. And as you say, the judges are here, they're there, they're in this pocket, they're in that pocket. They're in patches of the people rather than dealing with the people nationally. Is that fair, do you think?
I mean, yeah, they're not on a national level. They're basically taking out fires.
Sure. Yeah, that's good.
They're basically going out and taking out fires. That's what they're doing. There's a fire here. Let's get take care of it.
Yeah.
There's no deep, what can you basically call root canal? someone digging through and taking care of the actual problem.
Sure. Yeah.
But on the other hand, the book also tells us something else. It also tells us that, and we already saw that in Joshua, but now we're seeing it here even more, is actually God left these nations to test the people of Israel.
That's what we're going to read about. That's exactly right. And so,
but before you start, I want us to give us a clear division here. Chapter one, and basically chapter one, then chapter two, all the way to verse five, including verse five, is what we can call a prologue, an introduction to what's going to happen. It's giving us a very, very quick view of the main battles that happened after Joshua died. And it gives us several main characters as well, main stories. And then we have in chapter 2 from verse 6 to verse 10 is the opening. We can look at it as the opening of the book, the official opening. And then the stories actually begin. And we have to read it this way because we have to ask ourselves the question, why is Joshua suddenly back to life?
This is how it begins. After the death of Yehoshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked Jehovah, saying, who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? Jehovah said, Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hands. So Judah said to his mate Simeon, his brother, he said, hey, come up with me.
Shimon,
it'll be fun. Come along. And Shimon said, righto, I'll do that. And when I go to deliver my land, you can come with me. And so they made a bit of a deal. But it goes on. Now, before you said, you were talking about the berserk button. How do we pronounce this in verse 4? Then Judah went up and Jehovah delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men at
Bezek.
Bezek. There you go.
Bezek. That's the Israeli phone company.
Is that right?
No. The Israeli phone company, the general phone company here in Israel is Bezek. But Bezek is a city. It's actually the Canaanite city, a well-known Canaanite city.
So it's not Berserk.
But it's interesting, the name, Berserk. But the name Perizi, the Perizzite, or Perizi, is an interesting name. Remember, we spoke in Joshua in the beginning. We talked about the names of the people. So again, the Canaanites is a general name. Sometimes we refer to as the Canaanites or the Amorites. But then we have the Hivites and we have the Perizzites and everything. And I mentioned that these names probably represent not necessarily actual names of nations, but something else. So again, Perizzite is from the word Perez, which basically means Perazot. And we have this name appear again in the song in chapter 5. So Perazot basically means the people who live basically in open cities. Okay, so it could be that these were not actual names of nations. These were names of realities that people lived in. So they looked at them as the nation that lives in an open city, which is also very important. It's also very important because when we reach chapter 4, there's a whole discussion that we have to have about the people there in chapter 4.
Okay, we will do that. And they found Adoni Bezek in Bezek.
His name is Adoni Bezek.
The Lord of Bezek.
The Lord of Bezek. This probably is not his real name.
Probably
it's
not.
Like the name, for example, Malki Tzedek. What was the other name we had? Malki Tzedek and Adoni Tzedek.
Adoni Tzedek.
So it's exactly. So Adoni Bezek, first of all, it's a construct, so it has to be that these two words are together. So Adoni Bezek just means the Lord of Bezek, and that was the kingship name. It's his title. It's not his real name.
Now, something befalls him, and we're going to read about it now, and they fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Then Adoni Bezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him, and Yoel, they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Ouch.
So why did they do that?
Well, they did
that because of the next verse.
The next verse, give it to us.
He says, and Adoni Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their thumbs of their hands and thumbs of their feet were chopped off, were collecting food underneath my table. But as I did to them, God paid back to me. And this is actually a very, very important thing. We see that, I don't know if we spoke about this before. I have this feeling that we did. But I'm going to talk about it again, just very quickly, is that we see the issue of retaliation, what's called midah keneged midah. Whatever you do, the word midah means a measurement. So it's an equal measurement of what one does, one receives back. We see this idea appear over and over again in the Bible. And it's interesting. Adoni Bezek basically kind of realizes his sin. And he says, wait, I'm being paid back. He might have even repented for what he did.
Perhaps. And it seems like he had a reputation for his cruelty.
He was a
cruel person, having 70 kings with their thumbs and toes cut off that used to gather scraps under his table. And it appeared,
that might be just, a general description just of an idea of them being his slaves. But mm-hmm. it also can mean, from myself, first of all, when you don't have a thumb, it's very difficult to pick something up. So if sure. they're eating scraps from his table, they can't really pick it up. They have to somehow grab it with their fingers. And mm-hmm. also, when you don't have your thumb on your foot, your big toe, you can't really
hold
walk.
A sword. And yeah, that's no, right. You can't run. Foot, that's for sure. You can't walk. You certainly there can't run, and you can't pick up a sword. So he's kind of disabled them in all now, facets of war.
Now the idea of eating off scraps from his table, he says actually under his table.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to basically imagine what sometimes a king's court would look like. He will be sitting on a higher place,
mm-hmm.
and he'll have his table in front of him. And then there were people who sat lower. Now, it could be that not 70 of them were actually at the same time, but they will bring them out for amusement. And he would sit there and throw food at them, and they'll mm-hmm. somehow try to pick it up and eat. And they're on the floor because they can't stand up. There's no toe. Mm-hmm. There's no big toe to keep the leg up. Because you have to remember, there's actually two toes in your leg that you have to be able to walk.
Sure.
It's your big one and the small one. You'll be surprised. The little toe, the pinky toe, is actually important, surprisingly enough.
For one's balance. And so it paints a picture of a fairly cruel individual. And mm-hmm. and as he had done, so God had repaid him. And they brought him to Jerusalem. But it seems, Yoel, as a result of his the wounds that were inflicted upon him in judgment, perhaps he bled to death because he died.
No, not necessarily. You really have to open up a main artery to bleed to death. He probably just died there at one yeah. point. He might have died from gangrene, might have died from some kind of an infection or something. And he might have lived to an old age and died there as a petty little, petty beggar or something. It's not very clear. But he's taken to Jerusalem, which is also very, very important, because Jerusalem is a Jebusite city.
Uh-huh. And here it is in first sight that the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. And they struck it with the edge of the sword, and they set the city on fire. And afterwards, the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains of the Negev in the lowlands. And Judah went against...
Wait a second. There's something you missed out here.
Ooh.
They fight Jerusalem, and they smite it by the sword, and they burnt the city.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the city in Jerusalem the same thing?
Ah, fill me
no.
in.
The answer is no. Jerusalem is a district. And it's even in the letters of El Amarna, for example, which are very important letters which were discovered in El Amarna, which is in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Jerusalem is an area.
And the city is within the area.
And the city is within the area. It's the capital, and this area is called Jerusalem based on the name of the city. Right. Now, this is also very, very important, because when we skip to verse 21,
mm-hmm.
It says, "In the Jebusite which sit in Jerusalem, the tribe of Benjamin did not conquer, and the Jebusite sat amongst Benjamin in Jerusalem until that very day." Will you just destroy Jerusalem? So here's a bit mm-hmm. of geography. Tribe of Judah are south of Jerusalem. Tribe of Benjamin are north of Jerusalem. Jerusalem basically is smack in the middle between the two tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever, basically the tribe of Judah probably conquered the southern part of the area called Jerusalem and conquered the city.
City and burnt it.
And burnt it. And mm-hmm. Benjamin from north was struggling with the other part of the area called Jerusalem, and mm-hmm. they couldn't defeat them. And that's probably why we have Jerusalem showing up again. So Jerusalem is not really a name, is not necessarily the city. It's actually the province of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Very good point. Glad you brought that up. And from there, they went against, it goes on to talk. Oh, now, let me jump to 12, if I may. Caleb said, whoever attacks...
Ooh, Caleb. Who exactly is Caleb?
Fill everybody in. Remind everyone who the dog is. The faithful dog.
But the thing is that what exactly is the family of Caleb? Because they're also called, the family is also called the family of Yefuneh. They're also called the family of Kenaz.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kenizi, the Kenazite, were also another nation. Ooh, there's several theories about this thing, but the classic understanding from understanding the Bible is that no, they were from the tribe of Judah, and they were always from the tribe of Judah, and there's no issue. Some scholars, and I actually understand where they're coming from, actually say that there's a good chance that the family of Caleb were Kenizzites. They joined the people of Israel at one point.
Mm-hmm.
At a very, very early stage, probably still in the desert, or maybe even before that, they mm-hmm. might have been Kenizzite slaves who were in Egypt, and they joined the Israelites and joined the tribe of Judah, and they were very, very faithful to a point where basically people saw them as literally part of the tribe.
Yeah.
Now, this is a theory. I've heard this theory from several directions, but they actually say that they actually say that there's a good chance that they weren't actually originally Israelites because of the names. It's a very, very strange series of names. I just remembered you cut me off when I started talking about Segal. I was about to say something about Segal and his book, and what I was trying to say there specifically was the issue of the Canaanites. Mm-hmm. Segal, what happened is, and so I'm going to go back for a moment. What happened is that in the 1900s, sorry, the 1800s, it was very, very popular to believe in Darwinism and evolution. And they actually influenced the thought, the mind, the thought pattern of a lot of people, where everyone started, you know, that was the trendy thing of the time. So now they're going to compare everything to evolution. It's like when, you know, if you know, social psychology becomes the big thing, so everyone's going to analyze things up from that pattern. So that's actually quite common in the research world. Each time something else becomes trendy, that's what they're going to compare it to. And he dealt with the theory that the Israelites were really Canaanites who became Israelites because, they were the low class of the Canaanites, so they decided to become a complete separate entity. Mm-hmm. And really, there's no difference between the Canaanites and the Israelites. And then, you know, then the Israelites come out into play. But the problem is that there's a real problem with that, because the fact that there's suddenly two kingdoms, and we know these two kingdoms existed because they're mentioned in different places besides the Bible. Mm-hmm. And a kingdom, a complex kingdom, can't show up out of nothing. So what he basically said in his book was, because of this issue of trying to compare everything to evolution, researchers try to compare the development of the people of Israel through evolution by saying these were Canaanites. And he basically says we have to dismiss a lot of these theories because of the exterior influence of other theories on the actual research. It's an issue with researchers in general that they pull out a piece of information, depending what angle they look at, they come with a different interpretation. But the moment someone says, well, I'm going to come from a biblical interpretation, then everyone goes like, oh, no, you be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens a lot.
Chapter 15 of Joshua, from verse 13 to verse 19, which just gives a little bit more detail in regards to the story that we're about to read in regards to Caleb and what went on. But basically, he said, whoever attacks, is it Kiryat Sefer? Is that how I pronounce it?
Kiryat Sefer, the town of the book.
The town of the book. Okay. And takes
It's interesting. Why is it called Kiryat Sefer, actually? Because it can be actually Sefer from the word Sfar, which means the city, which is on the edge of civilization or something. Because something which is on a Sfar is on the edge of something. So it might be that they changed it Kiryat Sefer just because of the way it's constructed. But it might be that the word was Sefer, which means book. Mm-hmm. Let me pull out a commentary about this. I mean, I don't know. It really depends where the city was. It might have been on the edge of the desert or something. Because we're basically dealing with the land of Judea.
Mm-hmm.
So Kiryat Sefer. Someone here says it's also called Kiryat Sana. Interesting. Kiryat Sana. Interesting. Doesn't really give me much about the name. But it might be the city of the book. It might be also be a bit of a mistake in the vowel points. And it should be Sefar or something, which means the city on the edge.
Okay, maybe. Well, see, now you're making me go back a couple of verses, because it says in verse 10, then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron, and now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiryat Avar. Is that right?
Avar. Yeah, Kiryat, the town of the four. But the reason it's the town of the four is because there were four giants living there.
Uh-huh, there you go.
Haman, Sheshai, Talmai, and something, the sons of the Rapha.
The sons of there's mention of the three sons of Anak too that we're going to read about in verse 20. But
yeah, there were giants there.
There were giants there. And so Caleb said, "Hey, whoever attacks this place and finishes them off, I'll give them my daughter Achsa, as wife, and Otniel, is that right?
Otniel, yeah.
Son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it, and so it happened that she became his wife." And now, verse 14.
So, by the way, this verse is very, very important. This verse is very, very important because there's an argument in between rabbinical Jews and Karaites regarding can a person marry his niece?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Torah says in was it Leviticus 18 or something, it says there that not to take the aunt, not to be with the aunt.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're saying, oh, so it's also reversed. Everything is also reversed.
But it's, you know,
it's also the uncle, but it doesn't appear there at all. Yeah, so this is why I said regarding the issue of the family of Caleb. So he's called Caleb ben Yefuneh, mm-hmm. the son of Yefuneh, and he's called Otniel, the son of Kenaz. And the Karaites come up and say, well, they're not really brothers. They were distant relatives, but they were called brothers because of their distant. And I don't really remember if there's anywhere in the Bible where the word brother is applied in that way of being a distant relative. It's usually words like Goel or a redeemer, basically, like we have in the book of Ruth. Which is, by the way, a parallel. The story of Book of Ruth is a parallel to the story here in the Book of Judges, towards the end of the Book of Judges. You also have words like Ben Dodoy actually does appear, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So brother usually, it might sometimes mean blood relation, but it usually just means literally brother. I mean, I can look it up in the dictionary and see, and I won't be surprised if they do mention that it might be cases where it is related. Is connected to being a blood relation, but not necessarily brother. But here in this case, Caleb is actually named after the name of his father, who was called Yefuneh. Mm-hmm. Otniel is named after the family he belongs to.
Mm-hmm.
So he's from the family of Kenaz, but they were actually probably were brothers.
Okay,
they're probably actually really brothers.
Now, as we see later,
and he's
on.
Mentioned, and by the way, he's mentioned as Caleb's younger brother.
Yeah.
Why would they be, if they're cousins so or something specific. Like that, why would they mention such a specific detail?
That's right.
And I you agree. Can't say, oh, they sinned here. This was a sin.
Well, you know, Otniel becomes a judge, as we're going to read about a little bit later on. But
and Otniel becomes a judge as well. He's not a lot of information about what happened with him, but he becomes a judge as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the problem. Don't try to insert into the text something which is not there. And that's an issue that I've dealt with lately a lot. Where a text says something else and someone's trying to interject an intelligent thought into it, but that's not what the text is saying.
Amen. Yeah, so we've got to be careful of that. So it happened. Now I have a question here. Now it happened that when she came to him that... What do you have in the Hebrew? Verse 14.
When she came to him, v'tasiteu lish'ol, she convinced him through deceive.
She?
V'tasiteu, it's feminine.
It's
but
feminine.
The who becomes... Yeah, she caused her husband, who happened to be Otniel, to convince his brother to give him places with water. These places called Gulot.
That's interesting because the Septuagint and the Vulgate says that he urged her, but in the Hebrew it says she urged him.
Sitehu. Yeah.
There it is.
It's actually feminine. It's quite clearly feminine.
So that's clear. And to ask for a piece of land. And Caleb says to her, what do you wish? And so she says, give me a blessing since you've given me the land.
But by the way, the Septuagint, this is a very, very good example of a serious error. Because v'tasiteu lishol me'et aviha. She encouraged him to ask from her father. Aviha is feminine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the whole sentence, who's the subject of the sentence? She is.
Mm.
I really, with all due respect to the Septuagint, this is a classic example of a mistake.
Of a very, very clear mistake. And so there's one. Of many. And so Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. There you go. That was nice. Now, the children of the Kenites, that would be Yitro, right? Are we talking about Yitro, Moses' father-in-law?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the Choten Moshe can also mean the ones who relate to him through marriage. Because, for example, there's several people mentioned as Choten Moshe. There's Yitro, there's Yeter, and there's Reuel. So it could be that all three names belong to the same person. It could be that Yitro was the actual father of Tzipporah. Yeter might have been some kind of a derivative or shortened version of the name Yitro, but who's this Reuel person? But he's also referred as Reuel as Choten Moshe. So the Choten probably means the person that's related to you by marriage.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay.
And so what happens here in verse 16 and 17?
So they actually left the place called the City of Dates, Irat Emarim, which is probably the city of Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Deuteronomy 34, verse 3, Jericho, the city of Dates, that's more or less how it's mentioned there.
Okay.
And they leave with the people of Judah to the desert of Judah, to the Negev of the place called Arad, which is a city that still exists today, and we actually have also, they excavated the original city of Arad.
Oh, wow.
And this is an introduction to something important that happens later on. But then they battle, and Judah and Simon continue striking the Canaanites in a place called Tzfat. Now, it's not Zephad or Tzfat of today, which is up north. We're talking something which was probably a lot more south. I'm actually looking at a map here, and they're actually saying it's a town next to the creek of Azza, which is basically I think it's southeast of the city of Gaza of today. And they destroy this place, and they actually change its name. It says Vayachrimu ota Vayikra Shem Ha'ir Chorma. They destroyed the city, and they called it destruction.
There it is. Okay, they called it destruction.
So it's a game on. Yeah, it's a game on. Where we actually have another case like this in the Book of Numbers when they go to battle and they say they lose a battle. So they say, if you give it to us, we'll destroy it. And then they call the place destruction as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or desolate, whatever you want to call it.
And so
and
Judah,
they basically go, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, 18, Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territories. Now,
these are all Philistine cities. These are all now, Philistine areas. Now, the Philistines, by the way, were there's two types of Philistines, by the way. There's probably, at least the claim is there's two types of Philistines. The early Philistines, the times of Abraham, and the Philistines that came over later on from basically Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they worshipped a god called Dagon, because it was basically a type of Poseidon.
Yes, yeah. And so now this is, now Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron, now they were part of Israel, and now they're not. Am I right? All of those areas are now...
Well, we have, you have to understand, the Philistines kind of dwelt on the seashore,
mm-hmm.
and actually probably reached way, way up north. And the actual, the original city of Gaza, I'm not 100% sure exactly where it was, but actually the majority of what's called the Philistine lands of that time are actually today under Israeli rule. Ashkelon, there's a city of Ashkelon today. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's the original Ashkelon. Ekron, the original city of Ekron, I think is actually being excavated as we speak as well.
Sure.
The majority of what's called Philistine land is actually under Israeli rule today.
Mm, okay. So let me now I have a question. This is verse 19, and this goes back to the conversation that we started off with before we got into the book of Judges. So Yehovah was with Judah. It's very clear Yehovah was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. Now, clearly we're not saying Yoel, we're not saying that the chariots of iron were more powerful than Yehovah, not more powerful than the Lord, right? I mean, what is being said here?
It's a very good question, but we have to remember that at this stage there's no miraculous intervention.
Right.
These are natural walls.
So God is with them, but he expects them to fight, and he's getting them to actually engage in battle here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some things that they're coming up against that they, right at this point in time, they can't seem to get over. I find that really interesting.
And they probably were mostly dependent on infantry, and they didn't have any chariots and probably no horses. I mean, you have to remember, when you look at the reality, these were... they didn't have an organized military. This was just whatever weapons you had. So one guy came with a club, the other one came with a pitchfork, the other one came with, he was a bit more sophisticated. He put a piece of rock at the end of a stick, and he sharpened it, and now it's a spear. And another guy comes over with, he's got a bow and arrow suddenly, or a guy has a slingshot. It was very, very primitive, and they're dealing here with well-established nations. That they reach a point, they go like the height of technology. They have chariots. Mm. This is we're not dealing with tribes fighting one another. This is a bit more serious.
And so this is the point that you were making earlier, that although God is with them, he expects them to go and fight with them, and sometimes the victory is not immediate. And
exactly.
And so here is an example, just right here in verse 19. And here it begins, Yoel. Here begins the buts, and it begins with. Well, let me read 20. And they gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses said, and he expelled from there the three sons of Anak, right? But then from 21 on, we have the buts. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. The Jebusites dwelt, this is, as you pointed out. Then there's another but down a bit further down. They sent spies, and the spies said to a particular man, hey, if you show us the entrance, we'll let you live. So they let... But they let the man and his family go, and the man went to the land of the Hittites and built a city and called its name Luz,
The Hittites were up north. Mm-hmm. They were very, very up north, and they were the arch enemies of the Egyptians, by the way, at the time.
Really, yeah. Well, just one man, he goes and builds a city there. And then verse 27, but Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants. And we see this over and over again.
It's consistent. It happens over and over again. They're not. being able to kick out the enemy. Right.
Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites, nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants, nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants, Naphtali drive out the inhabitants, and it goes on to say in verse 34, the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. And so there's a problem because they're watering down their strength in a sense by allowing the enemy to dwell with them. And it takes me back to, in fact, before I get there, let me read verse 3 of chapter 2. We're in chapter 2 now. It says...
Wait. You're skipping something important.
Bring us through the first few verses of chapter 2, and I'll make my point after that.
So actually says in the first verse, it says, Vayal malach adonai min hagilgal el abochim. There's this malach, which is the classic word for messenger. Now, first of all, I want to be very blunt here. I don't think this was an angel. I think this was a person. Really? This person was a prophet. Okay, to be very, very blunt.
Because why would he be, unless he lived a Gilgal?
And he's traveling. He's traveling from a place called Gilgal to a place called Bochim.
That's right.
So he's physically walking.
Amen.
Okay, so it can be an angel looking like a human being, like we have, for example, with the three angels that appear to Abraham. Yes, those were three angels, and it's very evident that these were three angels, and not messengers, human messengers, and most definitely, there's another theory that comes from the Christian world, and people know what I mean, which is the theory itself is very problematic, and this is probably a person, and we actually have in the book of Haggai, for example, Haggai speaks of himself. It's in chapter 1, verse 13, I think. And it actually says, yes, I am looking at some notes I made. And and basically, he calls himself a messenger, a malach l'malachut Adonai. He's an angel in the angelic or the messenger purpose of God. Mm-hmm. So there's actually no reason to say this was actually translated as an angel, but a messenger. Mm-hmm. So just so you know, the word malach in Hebrew in general means messenger. Mm-hmm. Then we have the concept of malach, which is usually referred as malach Adonai, for example, as an angel of God. And he goes and he speaks to them and he says, I took you out of Egypt and I took an oath to your ancestors and I told them I'll never break the covenant, the word brit, covenant with them. And I told you not to cut a covenant with other nations. So he's mentioning the covenant with the ancestors. Now they're making the mention. It seems that they were making agreements with these nations, and then these nations were exploiting these agreements. Reminds you of something? Exploiting these agreements to attack and to take over. Okay, they came in peace. They made an agreement. And then the enemy says, "Oh, about that agreement? Yeah, about that." Mm-hmm. And he tells them not to cut agreements with them, not to have any covenants with them. And I told you to go destroy their places of worship, and you did not listen to me. And I told you I will not expel them from in front of you, but I will make them as obstacles on your way. So this is a repeat. This is a repeat from Deuteronomy.
And also Numbers, specifically Numbers 34. In fact, a number of places, but I'll just read Numbers 34, 55, and 56. It says, but if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes and thorns in your side. They shall harass you in the land where you dwell. Moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them.
So I take this as a personal hint to my generation as well.
Amen.
And I do agree. I did earlier mention this whole thing about God. You know, I did talk against someone who said something about him. God, you know, will take care of it and everything. And I'm taking this every time I read these types of verses. I take it as a hint to my own people, because essentially, unfortunately, the majority of people living in Israel believe in God, but a majority of people also don't want to follow Torah. Mm-hmm. And that's because they've been brainwashed.
Mm-hmm.
So God brings these enemies to drive us up the wall. To get us unified again and then unified under the Torah. The problem is that in every generation, we also have the ones who fight that. And there hasn't been anyone to pick up the glove yet to say, okay, I'm going to take up the challenge and say, okay, now that we've realized what's going on, here what has to be done. And there's no rabbi, there's no community spiritual leader here in Israel to pick up the glove and say, okay, this is what has to be done. It's all what we call in Hebrew putzi mutzi. It's all like being nicey to people and saying certain things about how wonderful keeping Shabbat is on the nice side of it, and not realizing, okay, this is also a covenant with God. No one's done that yet. Now, I I remember I used to talk to a certain level about this, and people say, how dare you say that? And who gave you the right to say that? Mm. And I remember, you know, I there was even in a conversation I once had, and people were saying, where was your God during the Holocaust? And I said, well, there's a covenant, and we have to uphold our end. Amen. And we didn't, and that's why it happened. And I got yelled at. And the people still want to talk with me again.
That's incredible, Yoel, because the difference between that kind of reaction and the reaction that they have in verse 4, when the messenger of Yehovah spoke these words to all the children of Israel, they didn't say to him, how dare you say that to us? Don't you understand the position that we're in? Where was God when we were trying to do this and that? They didn't do that. All the people lifted up their voices and wept. And they called the name of that place.
I'll tell you, it's very, very difficult. I remember there was a period of time when I spoke out loud for several years to a lot of people regarding the issue of keeping Torah, but not. I wasn't violent about it. I wasn't aggressive about it. Mm-hmm. I just basically answered very, very bluntly, and I was very, very blunt about it. And people have difficulty with it. Mm. People have difficulty hearing blunt things, because it makes us squeamish. And I don't want to hear blunt things either. You know, when someone tells me I'm wrong about something and they make a very clear statement about it, no one enjoys it. But in this case, we're talking about a situation of life and death. We are in covenant with the God of Israel. Amen. We have our end of the agreement to fill in. We can't just always turn around and say, oh God, I want X, Y, Z. He's going to turn around to you and say, but we have an agreement, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's another point that has to be made out. And believe me, I remember years ago, I met this man who wasn't even Jewish, but he was a great supporter of Israel. And he turned around to me and said to me, when are you, the Jews, going to do what God told you?
Mm.
And it echoes every time I think about it. It echoes in my head what this man said. Mm. A person who, by the way, believes in the God of Israel, but is not Jewish, turned around to me and said to me, and this was at the height of my ultra-Orthodox time, and he turned around to me and said, when are you going to do the will of God?
Mm.
When are you going to internalize this? He wasn't specifically talking about me directly, yes, but he was in general saying, and that echoes in my head every time I think about it.
Because
it's true, it's truth, and it's uncomfortable to hear it.
And isn't it the message that the messenger of Yehovah was saying to the children of Israel, when are you going to do it? When are you going to be obedient? When are you going to stick to the covenant that we made? And so they lifted up their voices and wept. They called the name of the place Bochim, which means weeping, right?
Yes, it's weeping or weepers. And it's interesting also, you have this in the Bible sometimes, that it says that he traveled from Gilgal to Bochim. It already mentions the name of the place, though it's not been named that yet. And that happens every once in a while. We also have that, for example, it says Moses went to Chorev, which happens to be the mountain of God. The original name was Chorev, but the text calls it the mountain of God even before it actually becomes the mountain of God, before God actually appeared on the mountain itself.
There's another example. And they sacrificed there to Yehovah. And now here we are at verse 6.
And here's the official opening of the book.
The official opening of the book after that. I tell you what, I think we're going to deal with the rest of chapter 2, and we'll kick off with chapter 3 next time. And when just to let everyone know, we were saying to each other before, hey, do you reckon we could get to the end of chapter 6? Boy, that'd be good if we could do that, but we're going to run out of time. And yes, when Joshua had dismissed the people the children of Israel, they each went to his own inheritance to possess the land. So the people served Yehovah all the days of Joshua, all the days of the elders, outlived Joshua, who had seen the great works of Yehovah, which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, Yehoshua bin Nun, the servant of Yehovah.
By the way, it's Yehoshua. It's slowly.
Yehoshua.
Not Yehoshua, because you're trying to imitate.
Yehoshua.
It's Yehoshua, not Yehoshua or something like that, because that's basically an imitation of the English way where people say, for example, instead of saying Yeshua, they say Yeshua or something like that, or the way they would pronounce God's name, the way Nehemiah does, and then they throw in this extra oomph to the sound just to make it sound very American. So here's a very, very important thing about Hebrew words. Mm-hmm. Most Hebrew words are accented at the end. Every time I teach this, every time I start a Hebrew lesson, I tell students, when I start with someone new, I always tell them, by the way, the accenting of the word is at the end in most cases, not in the beginning, unlike English. So it's not shalom, it's shalom. Okay? And it's not Yehoshua, it's Yehoshua. I'm not making fun of your of the
no, I know, well. You're not, but I'm laughing because you've told me this so many times that I keep getting it wrong.
Yes, you're a bad student.
HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com is the email. Now,
but by the way, I'm actually at the moment, thank God, more or less fully booked. So
get in line, get on the list. Because
so basically, if you really want to wait, I should have openings in the next couple of months because I'm about to finish cycles with people. So if you want to get on the waiting list, it's possible. If you don't want to wait on the waiting list,
Get on the waiting list. So he was 110 years old, and they buried him within the borders of his inheritance at Timnat Heres. Is that right? In the mountains of Ephraim.
Yeah, Timnat Heres or Timnat Chares, Kifel Chares.
The north side of Mount Gash.
Yeah.
Okay.
Other than the word Gash, Har Gash today in modern Hebrew actually means a volcano. But it wasn't. It was probably just a name called Gash. It's not necessarily a volcano.
Okay.
I'm just mentioning something. Here's a case of a difference of usage of words from modern Hebrew to biblical Hebrew. So yes, modern Hebrew and biblical Hebrew are very close, but they actually are different.
Okay. When all the generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know Yehovah nor the work which he had done for Israel. And here, from here we begin the woeful, terrible, sad story of Israel's unfaithfulness and what they did, and to the judges. Do you want to take us through it from verse 11?
So basically it says they worshipped the Baalim, Baalim, which is the plural Baal,
yes.
And they left the Lord, who was the God who brought them out of Egypt. And it basically gives you a cover of things. So for example, they left the God and they worshipped Baal and Ashtaroth, which was another, maybe it's Ishtar, no, it won't be Ishtar, it's Ashtaroth with an ayin. And God's wrath fell upon the people of Israel, and he gave them the hands of the people, gave them the hands of Shasim. So there actually was a nation called the Shasu, which were, they went as hordes and attacked places. So not necessarily the means that this was the Shasu, but it's interesting that they decided to take, maybe this is the original meaning of the words, and they took the name of this nation and used it at one point as a verb. So, for example, the Vikings would go on a Viking, which was basically
I was going to ask you, because I don't have the name of a people I have in my translation, so he delivered them into the hands of the plunderers.
So plunderers, again, the word shesa means to cut something. So they would go plunder by war. A shesa is a cut in something, and they were called the shasu, so they probably used the shasot something at something. They just used they took a noun and turned it into a verb, like the word Viking. So that might be it. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know, but I have a feeling that this is what actually happened here.
Interesting.
And he actually gave them vayim kerem. So to call someone is to literally give them. It wasn't if they were just being attacked. It wasn't. They were given under the authority vayim kerem. It says vayim kerem beyadoi vehem misaviv. He gave them away. He sold them. Call us to sell. He sold them away to the enemies that surrounded them. And every place that they will go out, the hand of God was at them for evil, for defeat.
And they put themselves in that position. They did it to themselves,
And what's important here as well to understand is that the same way that we expect the good to happen, the evil also happens. So he was actually upholding his side of the covenant.
Yes.
So, for example, when people, I think I mentioned this before already, when people say, oh, God abandoned Israel because they're suffering, no, that's upholding the other side of the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always nicey-nicey. It's sometimes, smacked in the face.
That's right.
If you have children, you know that.
And it's very, very clear. He says, if you do, everything's good. If you don't, look out.
So there's actually a famous story about Rabbi Akiva and his friends. And I don't know what people know about Rabbi Akiva, but I've heard a few interesting things about what Christianity talks about Rabbi Akiva and the dispute with Christianity. But there's an interesting story about Rabbi Akiva and two of his friends were walking around the Mount of Olives, and they were looking down towards the area where the temple sat, and they could still see the ruins. Actually, the ruins were there for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And they were looking, and they saw a fox walk out from the side of the Holy of Holies, and two friends started crying, and Rabbi Akiva started laughing. And they looked at him completely shocked and said, why are you laughing? He says, why are you crying? And they say, well, we just saw the holiest site in the world being desecrated, and a fox just walked out. And he said, well, that's exactly the reason I'm laughing. He says, you're insane or something? And he says, no. Until I saw the destruction happen, I did not know if the covenant still is upheld.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was destroyed means that the covenant still is still holding.
Because it confirmed what Yehovah said.
Because it confirmed the other end of the covenant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is why it's been emphasized. It wasn't just happened by mistake. There's something going on. And this is how I look at things. I try to look at things all the time. This is happening. We have to look at what's going on.
Mm.
And basically he says that every time they cried out to God and repented, then he sent them a savior. And that's repetitive, basically happened over and over again.
Mm.
And every time a judge came up, he repeats his all. Then when a judge dies, they go back, and then they send someone else again.
It goes up and down, saved, and up and down.
Yeah. Goes up and down, up and down, up and down.
And here enters the judges. This is, of course, from 16 on. I'll just read it in the English. Nevertheless, Yehovah raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them, yet they would not listen to the judges, but they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of Yehovah. They did not do so. And when Yehovah raised up judges for them, Yehovah was with the judges and delivered them out of the hand of the enemy all the days of the judge. For Yehovah was moved to pity for their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass when the judge was dead, that they reverted and they behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods and serving them and bowing down to them. And they did not cease from their own doings, nor did their from their stubborn way. Then the anger of Yehovah was hot against Israel. And he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and they have not heeded my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of these nations which Yehoshua left.
Yehoshua
left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel whether they will keep the ways of Yehovah to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. And there it is. There we have it. He has allowed them to stay there to test Israel, and it can't be any clearer than that. It can't be any more frank. Mm-hmm. Therefore, Yehovah left those nations without driving them out immediately, nor did he deliver them into the hand of Yehoshua.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. And, I mean, can we not claim that today? Can we not say that the reason why these nations are still irritants in the eyes and a thorn in the side of Israel is because they will not be obedient to the covenant?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I remember years ago someone once asked me, so what's the deal with the Arabs? And I said, let's just read the book of Judges. You know, he says, how dare you say that? I said, no, just read the book of Judges, and that's the only thing I can say to you.
Mm. And I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very good point. And it follows on from what we were so controversially talking about discussing last week. So there's some homework for the listeners. There's something to think about, and it needs to be put in the context of today as well, because it hasn't changed. It just has not changed.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I don't know that we're going to get. Should we continue on? I think maybe we might.
No, I think we should stop here and continue next week from chapter 3.
So next week we're going to pick up from chapter 3. We're going to be talking about some of the coolest stories ever in the whole of the Tanakh. I mean, some of these stories are just incredible.
But by the way, I think I just noticed something. There's a cultural thing that has to be explained here for a second.
Please.
When an Israeli says an Arab, I think I just figured something out.
Mm-hmm.
When an Israeli says an Arab, they usually mean a Muslim. So I might have actually last time said Arabs, and I meant to say Muslims. So that might be the reason why.
Fair enough. So just to clarify once again, last week, not speaking generally of Arabs, speaking generally of Islam. Just for now, they'll have to go and listen if they haven't listened already. But there you go. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. His Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. Thank you to everyone who has liked the page and who is engaging with the information there. And if you haven't done so already, you certainly should. And again, if you want to get on the list, in case the space opens up, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com is the email that you can contact the Levite in the land to try and fit in to get Hebrew lessons. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. And, oh, by the way, if you do, you go to truth2u.org on the right-hand side of the website there is a donation button that I'm trying to get myself with Keith. Keith has decided that he's going to do a tour in Israel. I'm trying to get over there with the equipment to cover that tour. For you guys, so you can listen to what's going on. Keith has said that after 10 years of in-depth study on the three T's, that's God's time, Torah, and Tetragrammaton, God's name, Keith is finally ready to invite some folks along with him on a journey to discover the land of Israel. He says if you are interested in joining him on an inaugural 3T tour to spy out the land of Israel in early March, to send him a note of interest on the contact page of hishallowedname.com. That's www.hishallowedname.com. Click on the contact page and just send him a note that you are interested. That is early March 2013. He says the first trip will have a limited space, so it'll be based on commitment and availability. He does warn us that we may get into some trouble with the religious police and the spiritual border patrol, and at some stage there'll be an all-night party at Yoel's house. So next week, there's going to be kicking off from Chapter 3. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Koko.